From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the first of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, In the Bible, Job Revisited. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University President Emeritus John Silber.
I'm pleased to introduce Elie Wiesel as he initiates his 33rd lecture series of Boston University. Some years it seemed difficult to introduce Elie without repeating myself, but this year it was easy. Since our last meeting, he's done so much that my problem is to select a few items on which to report. Elie has written two books since we met last, a novel, A Mad Desire to Dance, the style of which is a distinct departure from his earlier works. He employs a pattern of repetitions designed for a critical purpose, and the reader has the privilege of grasping the full significance of this trope. The second is a short book of appreciation on Rashi, who has been of critical importance in Elie's own education and in our development. Rashi, whose commentaries on the Talmud, the Midrash, and the Bible revealed meanings and complexities of these works, not only for Jews, but also for those Christian scholars who served King James in translating the Bible. But Elie's influence is by no means limited to his books. We all attend these lectures in part because Elie has convinced us that whoever listens to a witness becomes a witness. Millions have heard him in person, on the radio, through his books, and all have become witnesses, ensuring that the Holocaust and the inhumanity it records will never be forgotten. Several years ago, Elie denounced President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as a kind of fanatic who threatens mankind. He asked, "How is it possible that a nation expects this man, accepts this man who is mad, clinically mad, as a leader?" He noted that Ahmadinejad doesn't even attempt to hide his agenda of wiping Israel off the map. When in September 2008, Ahmadinejad was permitted to address a session of the United Nations, Elie protested. 1 year later, again, Elie pleaded with the international community to deny Ahmadinejad access to the General Assembly, where he could voice again his fundamental opposition to human rights, both in Israel and in Iran. Wiesel urged the international community to charge Ahmadinejad with crimes against humanity and bring him to trial at The Hague. Wiesel added, "He is an enemy of humanity." Elie's prediction of Ahmadinejad's performance was fully confirmed by his speech. Ahmadinejad began his diatribe by declaring his June re-election, despite its demonstrable fraudulence, as glorious and as fully democratic. He called once again for Israel's destruction and repeated his denial of the Holocaust. Elie's vigorous lecture schedule took him to several countries this year, to several venues this year and countries, where he addressed large bodies of students, assuring that future generations will continue to remember the Holocaust. A few years ago, Elie embarrassed the Romanian government by his stinging refusal to accept an honor without a confession on Romania's part of its participation in the Holocaust. Wounded by Wiesel's denunciation of Romania's failure to admit their participation, the government finally this year altered course and dedicated a monument to the memory of the Holocaust victims in Bucharest in the presence of survivors and government officials. Although Elie Wiesel was not present, he sent a message of respect and appreciation for the courage of Romanian authorities who finally recognized the persecutions, the murders, and the pogroms perpetuated in Romania during the war. He added, "This brings great honor to your nation." Using his influence and organizing leadership as a Nobel winner, Ely drafted and sponsored an open letter to the Iranian dissidents. He assured them that they were not abandoned and should not lose hope. "The world knows," he wrote, "that Ahmadinejad's election was shamelessly tampered with and that human rights of dissidents were violated." He said, and I quote, we are outraged by your government's denial of the basic liberties of its people." The letter closed by urging President Obama and the world's political leadership to support with all the means at their disposal the people of Iran, particularly those dissidents. Unfortunately, the United States did not respond. The highlight of Ely's year, I believe, was the speech he gave at Buchenwald in the company of President Obama and Chancellor Merkel of Germany. All their speeches were picked up by the international media, and Ely's words were heard by millions of more people than perhaps any other speech he has given. His invitation to address the assembly at Buchenwald was initiated by President Obama, who said that he needed Ely to give him his personal perspective on that terrible camp in which Ely's father died and from which Ely was liberated by American soldiers. Chancellor Merkel, in her remarks, acknowledged, and I quote, that we Germans see Buchenwald as a part of our country. She endorsed the appeal of the survivors of Buchenwald, again I quote, to carry on our struggle against Nazi idealism and ideology and for a just, peaceful, and tolerant world, a world that has no place for anti-Semitism, racism, xenophobia, and right-wing extremism. She stated, and again I continue to quote, this appeal of the survivors clearly defines the very special responsibility we Germans have to shoulder with regard to our history. Germans see it as a part of our country's raison d'etre to keep the everlasting memory alive of the break with civilization that was the Shoah. It is important, she added, to keep the memory of the great sacrifices alive that had to be made to put an end to the terror of National Socialism and to liberate its victims. In this, she thanked the United States, Great Britain, and all the other allies. She closed by emphasizing the obligation placed on us Germans as a consequence of our past to stand up for human rights, to stand up for the rule of law and for democracy. We shall fight against terror, extremism, and anti-Semitism. President Obama, in his remarks, noted that those who survived Buchenwald, and I quote, never could have known the world would one day speak of this place, or that some of them would live to have children and grandchildren who would grow up hearing their stories and would return here so many years later. They could not have known how the nation of Israel would rise out of the destruction of the Holocaust and the strong, enduring bonds between that great nation and my own. He then introduced Elie Wiesel. I thought, he said, it was appropriate to have Elie Wiesel provide some reflection and some thought as he returns here so many years later to the place where his father died. Elie Wiesel then spoke of his father and his visit as a way of coming to visit his father's grave if he had had one. He spoke of the darkest day of his life when his father died, and although he was there and nearby, he could not help him. But he thought, quote, one day I will come back and speak to him and tell him of the world that has become mine. I speak to him of times in which memory has become a sacred duty of all people of goodwill. What can I tell him that the world has learned? I'm not so sure. Mr. President, we have such high hopes for you because you, with your moral vision of history, will be able and compelled to change this world into a better place. Eli added with stark realism, but the world has not learned. You spoke of humanity, he continued, Mr. President, though unto us in those times it was human to be inhuman. Wiesel said it should now be your vision of the future, Mr. President, to ensure a sense of security for Israel, a sense of security for its neighbors, to bring peace in that place. The time must come. It is enough to go to cemeteries, enough to weep for oceans. It is enough. There must come a moment of bringing people together. Memory must bring people together. Once again, Eli spoke truth to power, as he did with Presidents Carter, Clinton, and Reagan. He is and continues to be a very special witness for humanity. Tonight, Professor Wiesel will speak on In the Bible, Job Revisited. It is not surprising that he would return once again to the book of Job, a profound, complex, and inexhaustible text. Just as scholars will forever ponder the complexities and conundrums of Hamlet and Lear, they will be fascinated by the book of Job, a book that has inspired many of our greatest literary artists, including Eli. Professor Wiesel.
Dr. Silver, thank you so much, as always, for your very personal introduction, which naturally illustrates our friendship since the day I came to Boston University. You spoke about my meetings with presidents. Believe me, to me, much more important is to be with my students here at this university. When I am in a classroom, that is where I am much more authentically that when I speak to very important people. My students are very important people. As for Job, once upon a time, in a faraway land named Uz, there lived a legendary man named Job. As you know, that is the opening line of the tale, rich in events and endowed with meaning that has been haunting not me alone, but also generations of scholars and students across cultures and memories. It is a dramatic tale filled with theological suspense and literary tension. And actually, as you heard, we have tried already twice at least to explore it in this setting. I love this book, but then I love every book in the Bible. I love books in general. And actually, I think a few years ago, I taught a class on the book of Job for a whole semester, long semester, and we came, I think, to chapter 10, that's all. We could have continued another 5 years and wouldn't have ended it. But this is only an introduction to the introduction of the book. It is extraordinary. And the question, of course, is why come back to it? Because the more we think we know the protagonist and his remarkable destiny, the more we realize that they have just begun. It is enough to open the book to be immediately confronted with new yet eternal questions, revelations, and mysteries that cannot but puzzle and fascinate anyone eager to discover what remains hidden in deceptively simple words and reverberations. In truth, all the moral problems metaphysical dilemmas and religious situations facing individuals and families are to be found in this story. Relationships between husband and wife, for instance, parents and their children, happy and fortunate people fallen into a life of pain and distress, their encounters with friends, the ambivalence of language and memory, the anguished connection between creator and his creation, the sacred and the profane, the danger of Satan's influence and power, related questions of blasphemy, resignation or suicide arise from certain parts of this timeless and so timely tale. Numerous books have been written, as you heard from Dr. Silver, and many more will be written on any one of these topics. It reads like a fable, almost a fairy tale for adults, with a quiet beginning, a thought-provoking middle, and a reassuring denouement. And decades from now, one autumn evening, in this university, someone else, your grandchild perhaps, will sit at the same table and again say, once upon a time. So let us open this great book of questions and confrontations. Let's again turn its pages, beginning with the first verse. Yes, once upon a time, in the land of Uz, there lived a man named Job. And this man was Etam, which means both innocent and whole. He was in all things perfect, fearing God and avoiding evil. The name of his father, it is unusual in scripture, but in this case it is unknown. His childhood, omitted. Who were his mentors? His teachers, unknown. A land named Uz, where is that land? It appears in three places in sacred volumes. Sardia Gaon places it near Damascus. Other cities, other sites are offered in Talmudic sources. However, both Maimonides and Rashi maintain that the name has no geographical significance. In fact, it could be everywhere or nowhere. Following the praise given Job, logically, the concerned reader is now awaiting a morally more positive development. Since our hero is so pious that the divine compliments covering him surpass even those bestowed upon Abraham or Moses, God will surely properly reward him. In fact, he has already been rewarded on a certain level. He is wealthy, thousands of lambs, 3,000 camels, 500 oxen, 500 she-asses. Also, he is the head of a marvelous, enviable family, a good wife, 7 sons, and 3 daughters. Furthermore, he is the greatest of men in the East. It's in the text, all that. So he's entitled to be happy. And he is happy with people and at peace with himself. That is the image we get from the text. And yet a faint doubt insinuates itself in the mind of the reader. First, the optimistic approach of the story is simply too beautiful to be true. Second, the book as such at first sight is too long. It needs an editor to shorten a page here, a chapter there. To extract its existential lesson, one chapter, one page or two, like the ones describing the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, would have been sufficient. We understand it already. And the story itself. When in my classroom students and I read a volume, old or new, fiction or non-fiction, the teacher always asks, what actually is the book about. So what is this story about? Is it about decisions made in heaven that affect the lives of human beings below? Is it a tale of sin and punishment? Of God's presence in history, perhaps? Is it about human fear and trembling and their possible meaning of ultimate absurdity? Is it just to make us wonder, if good deeds produce suffering, why be good? Why choose piety over cruel selfishness? And once suffering is inflicted on the individual chosen one, what does one do with one's suffering? Does it change the sufferer? Does it change the reader? And who is responsible for that suffering? God or... Listen. That Job's life was not so peaceful, we learn right from the outset. He does have problems with his children. Admit it. They were partying too much. Why weren't the parents invited, or at least informed? Job didn't know what they were really doing. He worried. And what if they sinned in their heart, he says. Neither he nor the reader could be certain that they did something wrong. Perhaps they did. So to cover all possibilities, Job decides to atone on their behalf, and he brings offerings to God. Question: how could such a father, pious and God-fearing, have such children? The story moves on with a high-level meeting in heaven. God's VIP angels, the term is the sons of God, appeared before him, and Satan was among them. Has he been invited? Not sure. Maybe because he was uninvited that God noticed him, probably with some faint surprise. He asked him, "Where do you come from?" Satan answered, "Oh, I don't know. I just took a walk down below." That is almost the language of the text. "Oh, really?" said God. "How interesting. By the way, did you happen to notice my good and brave servant Job? And don't you agree that there is no one like him in my world? Morally whole, upright, fearing God and avoiding evil, God gives it all." What follows is an astonishing dialogue between them, between God and Satan. One wonders, how could Satan, in the presence of other important angels, be so impudent with God? And why didn't they silence him? They could have advised him to speak with more respect. They said nothing. As for Satan, believe it or not, his argument is clever and predictable. "Why shouldn't Job be the perfect man you describe?" he says to God. "He's wealthy and happy. And everything he touches is blessed by you. But take everything away from him, and we'll see if his faith is still totally unblemished." "Good," said God. "His entire welfare is in your hands, but don't lay a hand on him." End of dialogue. Satan left the meeting. Were there reactions, interventions, commentaries, applause from the audience? Criticism? If yes, they were not recorded. Now the action moves quickly from Job to his sons and daughters. They ate and drank and had a good time at the oldest brother's home. What happened then we learn together with Job when a messenger knocked at the door with sad news, saying, "While oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, hostile Sabaeans appeared out of nowhere and slew them, and there came caretakers. I alone escaped to tell the tale." He was still talking when another came with his report. "A fire came down from heaven and devoured sheep and shepherds, and I alone escaped to come and tell the tale. He was still talking when a third messenger appeared with his story. Chaldeans raided our camp, took the camels and killed the drivers. I alone escaped to tell the tale. He hasn't finished talking when still another messenger arrived. Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking at the home of their eldest brothers when a huge wind came from the desert and shook the four corners of the house. All were killed. I alone escaped and came to tell the tale. Only then, we are told, did Job stand up and tore his clothes, fell to his knees and exclaimed, "Naked have I come out of my mother's womb, and naked I shall return to the earth. God has given, God has taken back. May his name be blessed." The text leaves Job in his distress and takes us back to heaven. So we saw Job in distress and in mourning and in heaven. On that level, on that heavenly level, the story continues. The sons of God presented themselves again before God with Satan again in their midst. And as if we were reading a well-prepared script written by whom, God asks Satan the same question, "Where do you come from?" And Satan gives the same answer, "Oh, he took a walk down below." And God responds as he did the first time, "Really? Have you noticed my servant Job, who is unlike any other in the land? He's whole, upright, and so forth. You see, it is in vain that you incited me against him." Satan does not surrender. "Naturally," he said, "he only lost his goods, his fortune, his belongings. But let me handle him, then we'll see what happens. As before, God consents, do to him, with him, whatever you wish, but he must remain alive." Job fell ill, his body broken, his skin untouchably repulsive, and really, Satan's role remains incomprehensible, disturbing, appalling. We'll talk about him next week, he can wait. But he is so disturbing that Rabbi Yochanan, a great sage, who in the entire Talmudic corpus felt incommensurate sympathy for Job, he made the following statement. He said, "This story, because of its implications, is so strange that were it not written, we would not dare to utter it. Satan, one of the sons of God? Yes, he'll wait. For now, our attention is exclusively turned towards Job, who is in bad shape. As he sat on the ashes of his dwelling, his entire body was in pain. Then, as if out of the blue, his wife turned to him, and she said, 'My dear husband, you still hold fast to your wholeness or to your innocence? Curse God and die.'" It is for the first time that we notice her altogether. Where was she until now? Did Job eat alone that evening? Did the messengers talk only to him? And now that she is here and she talks, what kind of advice is she giving her husband? To commit suicide? Or is it possible that her words are meant to help him, saying, "Better die outside faith, against faith, than in faith or with faith"? In fact, the verb she uses is barech, which means both curse and bless. And his answer is shocking. And he said, quote, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive the good but not the bad at the hand of God?" The expression in Hebrew is much worse, very unelegant. It is insulting. He calls it Achat Hanevayot, one of the wretched. And that was their first and last exchange in our version of the story. In the Septuaginta translation, her lines are more numerous. Septuaginta is more generous with her. She says, quote, "How long will you go on saying that you will wait and wait longer for your salvation while your very memory is faltering? My sons and daughters, fruits of my womb, are gone, and like a maidservant I go from place to place, from house to house, waiting for the sun to shine so I could rest in my distress. Curse God and die." And what happens then? In all the texts, both Babylonian and Judean, she disappears for good. Does she really? It's not clear from the text. It's quite possible that she remains on stage throughout the discussion or the disputation between her husband and his friends, not hers. But he remains silent. In apocrypha sources, mention is made of her continuous presence. Better yet, when the trial ends, Job is being rewarded. As we shall see later, he reconstitutes a family. He will have twice 7 sons and 3 daughters. But with whom did he have children? Will he remarry? Is this woman his second wife? No, some commentators disagree. For them, he was his first. She was his first. She was in the beginning, and she remained at the end. But who is she? Various midrashic sources tend to believe, or to make us believe, that she is Dinah. Yes, Jacob's only daughter. Surely you recall her tragic fate. The prince of Shechem or Nablus fell in love with her. Nice Jewish girl. So he raped her. Her shame was avenged by her 2 brothers, Shimon and Levi. And the entire male population of Shechem was wiped out. In both stories, the word nevala, wretchedness, appears. And no one, except in the fascinating fantasy of sages, has ever heard of Dinah again. But why did they marry her to Job? Hasn't she suffered enough? The only reason for this arranged marriage has to do not with her, but with him. Thanks to Dinah, Job belongs to the era of Jacob and Moses, which is needed to explain Job's trial, as we shall see later. For the moment, let's simply state that everything here is done to make our hero as elusive as possible, either geographically or biographically. Some sources question his name itself, not Job, but Yovav, son of Zarach, an Edomite. His birthplace, Uz, is quasi-mythical. So is his date of birth. Legend moves him all over time and space. Was he Abraham's contemporary? Esau's grandson? Or a neighbor of Joseph? An advisor to Pharaoh and possible acquaintance of Moses' father-in-law, Jethro? Was Moses the author of his book? Did Job live in the time of Judges? Or of Persia's king, Ahasuerus? Was he really an immigrant from Babylonian exile? Was he truly the head of an academy, of a yeshiva in Tiberias, as is the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan, who quotes Rabbi Eliezer? All of these story options were suggested. But the question is, was he Jewish at all? Not so, and not so sure. Some sages dispute this conclusion, claiming that he actually was a non-Jewish, virtuous, just man, or even an accomplished prophet to the Gentiles. Where and from what source do the sages take this daring hypothesis? Actually, from the text itself. Any psychologist would tell you that when tragedy strikes, the first impulse is denial. How come Job didn't ask the messenger a simple question? It's impossible. All of these things happen to me, only to me, in one day. Are you sure it's me? Maybe it's my neighbor. It's not 14, but 16. Had he been Jewish, he would have asked these questions. So because he didn't ask these questions, maybe the sages say that he actually was not Jewish. One text says, a pious man existed among the nations of the world, and his name was Job. I like that, even really, that we think that there can be pious people among Gentiles as well, good people, and that the Bible takes them in. He came into this world, says this text, only to receive his reward. Then the Holy One, blessed be he, inflicted suffering upon him, and he began protesting and cursing until the Holy One, blessed be he, doubled his reward. So many stories and contradictory theories have been offered in various sources. They could lead to confusion. Actually, to prevent confusion, Rabbi Shmuel, son of Nachmani, comes up with a revolutionary idea. He said, Iyof lo haya velo nivra. Job never existed. Ki im mashal haya. Simply, he was pure fiction. In this is the word mashal, a parable. He was only a parable. The great Saul Lieberman, my late teacher and friend, adds his own interpretation. To say that the story of Job is mashal haya, a parable, is not sufficient. What? Life parable. Such a life, simply a parable. Something is missing here, he said. One would say, ke mashal haya, that it was like a parable. And Lieberman added, or better yet, le mashal haya, life was to be made a parable. In other words, Job existed. And his suffering was real, but only in order to save as a story, a parable, to learn from it, yes, to learn from it how to deal with suffering, our own and that of others, and how to reconcile faith in God's compassion with his rigorous ethical principles of din, of justice. Thus, Job himself turns into an exemplary figure to be followed. To this day, Jews behave like him in matters of mourning. They tear their clothes and use his words humbly, Baruch Dayan HaEmet, accepting God's judgment of truth. God has given, God has taken. May his name be a blessing. If that is not enough, anyone who is familiar with Jewish liturgy for the high holidays, it is penetrated by sayings, verses from Job, a non-Jew. The stage is set for the next phase in his life. Enter his three friends. The laws of mourning are still observed. They speak only when he speaks. We must learn from that when we visit a mourner. They eat only if he eats. They rise only when he rises. For 7 days and 7 nights his lips are sealed. So are theirs, because, says the text, they witnessed his great pain. Were they united in silence? In the silence, then, is the silence of the victim the same as that of the comforter or the spectator? They may use the same words, but is their meaning the same? Do they convey the same experience? Next question, had Job not been silent, had his friends not been silent, would he have found the words to curse the day of his birth? Would he have cursed at all? Does the language of silence produce more silence or other words? Furthermore, who are the three friends? We know their names and origins. Eliphaz the Yemenite, Baldad the Shuhite, and Sofer the Naamathite. One Breita suggests that, like Job himself, they were prophets to the non-Jewish world. They must have known Job and his family and heard of his plight. Also, they must have been in contact. Otherwise, how did they manage to arrive together at the same time? Again, I always quote the Apocrypha book called Divrei Iyov, Words of Job. And that book declares that the visit occurred 20 years after the event itself. But the question facing us then is, why did they wait so long? 20 years. And why was Job still in mourning? Is this version given only to tell us that Job's mourning lasted so long that he couldn't console himself? Isn't overextended grief against Jewish law? In the same ancient text, the three visitors look at Job with disbelief, and even before he opens his mouth, wonder. This man was so generous, they ask each other. He helped so many poor people in surrounding cities and villages. Why does he deserve such suffering? More or less similar questions are raised in the biblical story, but later. After all, this first episode, says the biblical text, after this long silence, Job opened his mouth and cursed his life. The text uses the term vayan, he replied. But to whom? Not to his friends, since they were still silent. He replied with words, his own silent thoughts. He replied to himself. And he said, Yovat yom ivalet bo, may the day I was born perish, and the night which announced the male child is born, may that day be darkness, may God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let that night be barren. He wished he died when leaving his mother's womb. My request, he says, that God would grant my desire, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. That would be my consolation. Of his friends, he says, my friends are treacherous. As a torrent bed, as flashes that pass away, which are dark with ice. Further, he says, are not man's days like the days of a hireling, like a slave who longs for the shadow, who looks for his wages? So I am allotted months of emptiness. Nights of misery are appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night is long, and I am restless, full of tossing till dawn. And he declares, therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. He questions the purpose and meaning of his ordeal. He wants to know why, for what specific reason, he is made to endure such distress. He addresses heaven, asking, what have I done to displease you? What transgression am I guilty of? What sin have I committed? In other words, he asks God, what do you want from me? Must I even open a parenthesis? I remember terrible times, and I remember one very, very pious Hasidic Jew who simply, in the middle of all that, turns to heaven and said, Ribbono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, what do you want from us? What do you want from us? Job's outburst is followed by his friends' speeches. Are they meant to console and comfort him? Some sages answer in the affirmative. Quoting a verse from the Ecclesiastes, they say, it is better to go to the house of a mourner than in a house of rejoicing. Rabbi Shimon applauds them for doing precisely that. That's why they were rewarded by God by escaping their place in hell. Other sages disagree, and they judge harshly the friend's statement. So does God himself, and so do we. I don't like them. Between him and his pain, they choose God and his justice. They are not on his side. Each in his own way, with his own attitudes, offers him explanations rather than human solidarity. He is in pain and they speak theology. Instead of alleviating his pain, they increase it. They make him feel worse instead of making him feel better. Bildad the Shuhite answers first, quote, how long will you utter these things and the words of your mouth be a great wind? Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert the right and listen to his revolting response to Job's multifaceted agonizing woes? Quote, If your children have sinned against God, he has delivered them into the power of their transgressions, and I do not accept that. What does he want? What from his children? To say that children who die is because they sinned is a disgrace. It is an outrageous explanation. Now remember, Job has not denied God's existence, ever. He just questioned his impact on his life. And yet Bildad says, quote, "Can papyrus grow where there is no water? While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. Such are the paths of all who forget God. The hope of godless man shall perish." What? Job godless? Job forgot God? How dare Bildad, his supposed friend, level such accusations against him? And Job answers, "How can a man be just before God, who removes mountains, and they do not know when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place, and its pillars tremble?" No, Job denies neither God's existence nor his power. All he wants is to understand his awesome and mysterious ways in dealing with his creation. Not that he is unwilling to submit to God's will, he is, but he wishes to understand what it is and why it is at times for him to be happy or in distress. Is there no connection between heavenly compassion and divine justice? Or must divine harsh justice be answered by a human quest for concern and compassion for the other, always the other, but not for God's direct answer? One of Job's harshest critics is not among his three friends, it's a fourth, seemingly uninvited guest, Eliyahu, son of Rachel, the Buzite of the Ram family. And his part begins with his anger. He was angry at Job because he justified himself rather than God. What? Wasn't Job's instantaneous response to declare that God has given and God has taken back? Elihu was also angry at Job's friends for their poor dialectic in refuting his arguments. He said, "I am young in years, but you are aged, and therefore I was timid and afraid in speaking up until now. I waited for your words, but none confused Job, none answered his words properly. So I must speak, that I may find relief." And turning directly to Job, he reproaches him for not admitting that, quote, "God is greater than man. Why are you against him for not answering your words? God speaks in one or two ways, but man does not perceive it. Listen to me," he says. "Listen to me, O Job. Be silent, and I will teach you wisdom. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong." In truth, neither the friends nor Job answered Elihu. The attitude towards him is varied in ancient sources. Some sages praise him. Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah sees him as Isaac. Others blame him. Rabbi Akiba condemns him as being Bileam. Another sage is persuaded he is Satan. In the Apocrypha volume, he is the worst of them all. With Job, it is not the individual who wonders, searches, and argues. He is the reflection or representative of all members of the human family, and particularly those who are underprivileged and singled out for impossible situations with a complex testing process. All the poor, all the sick, all the prisoners could ask the questions that he is trying to answer. Job knows that he is not only innocent, but also God-fearing, avoiding evil and pious. God had told him that. It's in the book. Job must have read his own book. All he has to do is think about what God says. And since God tells him that his life is above reproach, he is simply unable to comprehend why he deserves punishment and pain. His three and later four friends do understand, or at least that it is the general substance of their discourse. Faced with ontological dilemmas, Job doesn't know, and they pretend that they do. Is this the gist of the story? Wait a second. We believe that Job doesn't know at all why his children were killed? No possible explanation? Oh, yes. Doesn't he say there that he saw something, they did something in their heart? But not really. First of all, for that kind of sin, they deserve to be killed. Furthermore, even if they sinned, why should parents be punished for the misbehavior of children? At one point, and here is a critical verse, Job states, "Hein yikteleini lo ayachel, let him kill me, I shall nevertheless yearn from him." Lo in Hebrew means either him with a vav or no with an aleph. In other words, the verse may read, "Let him slay me, but I shall continue having faith in him." Or it may also mean, "Let him slay me, but I shall not have faith in him." It is generally believed that Job was tested by God and that he failed due to his angry outbursts. But then how is one to explain that the story has never been considered for Geniza, meaning to be included in the list of forbidden readings? The Song of Songs was on the list, as was the Ecclesiast, but Job was not. One thing is clear. Wherever we turn with our analysis, Job remains at its center. That the friends are wrong, perhaps they talk too much, becomes evident since they are rebuked by God himself. But Job needs to see his predicament with absolute moral clarity. And here a well-known, extraordinary Midrashic parable is presented to the reader. It raises the question whether the story might simply not be the consequence of a terrible mistake made by God himself. And listen to the Midrash. And it says, "More in bewilderment than in sorrow, Job turned to God. Master of the universe, is it possible that the storm passed before thee, causing thee to confuse Eov, Job, with Oyev, the same letters, enemy?" As strange as it may seem, of all the questions raised by Job, only this one was answered. And God's voice roared in the tempest, "Pull yourself together, man, and listen. Many hairs have I created on the human head, and every single hair has its roots. I don't confuse roots. How could I confuse Job and the enemy? Many drops have I created in the clouds, and every single drop has its own source. I confuse neither drops nor clouds. How could I confuse Job and the enemy? Many thunderbolts have I created, and for each bolt a path of its own. I don't mistake one bolt for the another. How could I confuse Job and the enemy? Know also, Job, that the wild goat is cruel with its young. As they are about to be born, she climbs to the top of a very high rock and lets the little ones drop from the precipice. So I prepared an eagle to catch them on his wings. But were the eagle to arrive one moment too early or too late, they would fall to the ground and be crushed. I don't confuse moments of lightning bolts or drops or roots. And you are asking me if I am confusing Eov and Oyev, Job and the enemy?" Here Job is rebuked by God, who seems to say to him, "You don't know what I am doing and why, but I do. Let that be sufficient for you." Elsewhere, the Midrash goes farther and offers the ethical reasons for Job's divinely conceived plight, and that I like better. Listen. Egypt's Pharaoh had three equally influential advisors, Jethro, Bileam, and Job. And he consulted them on matters of state. So when the issue of slavery was put on the agenda and Moses appeared before him pleading, "Let my people go," he summoned them, the three of them, and requested their opinion. There must have been a real discussion with arguments in favor or against. And one said, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, was naturally on their side, pleading with his new family's friends and relatives. "What do you need them here?" he said to Pharaoh. "They only cause trouble. Other tribes may follow their example. Let them go, and there will be peace in the land." Bileam, the enemy's prophet, protested violently. "The Jews were born slaves," he said. "Let them remain slaves. You need their work, even their ingenuity. If they gain freedom, all the other slaves will want it too. Reject Moses' plea. Be harsh with his emissaries, and things will be all right." Caught between the two poles, Pharaoh turned to Job. "What did you think?" But did he think at all? We'll never know. All we know is that he didn't answer. He kept silent. Says the Midrash, it is because of his silence that he was made to suffer. Oh, we know that now, in times of danger, silence helps the victimizer, never the victim. Is that reason fully acceptable? As in other places, we may echo Midrashic discontent, asking if Job sinned, why were his children killed? We must stop again. Earlier we said that it was God's will that Job suffered. Was it really? Wasn't there someone named or nicknamed Satan? Hasn't it been his idea from the outset? Yes. But he was only one of many angels present at the Heavenly Morning Summit meeting. Why was he singled out by God who chaired the session? If God had not given him the floor, the book of Job would not have been written. The questions are pertinent. But Satan is, how should I say, our invited guest for next week. For the moment, let us simply suggest that Job's own quest for meaning and concern for justice cannot not appeal to our own. The great Hasidic master Rabbi Susya of Onipol, known for his lifelong misery, once exclaimed, "O master of the universe, I don't mind suffering as long as it is for your sake." Has Job also suffered for God's sake? Oh, when we spoke here for the first time 33 years ago, we expressed our lack of enthusiasm towards him in the beginning for submitting to God too quickly. At that time, we invoked the example of Moscow's infamous show trials, in which the celebrated defendants confessed to unthinkable and implausible crimes. They did so without arguing on details, just to tell us elsewhere later that they didn't mean it. Had they disputed certain charges but not others, the trials might have been accepted as warranted. But because they all of a sudden, immediately, submitted to the questions of the prosecution, accepting all stupid, absurd accusations, it is to tell us they didn't mean it. And that same attitude could be said of Job. Had he argued, the student of his life and struggle could have consented to agree with both prosecutor and judge. By not arguing, he suggested rebellion. Still, the real reason for his submission is to be found elsewhere. Job's fear was not that God is unjust. Who are we, human mortals, authors and victims of our own ambitions and frailties, even dare comparing our sense of justice to his? To do so would be blasphemy, wouldn't it? Job's fear was that, who knows, God on his throne might be indifferent to his creatures, and their silly or dramatic adventures here below, on our small, insignificant planet. So when God, late in the story, in chapter 38, finally addressed Job from the whirlwind, Job fell on his knees and was satisfied. Listen, he said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I shall question you. Where were you when I laid the foundations for the earth?" said God. "Who determined its measurements? Who stretched the lines upon it? Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Do you know the ordinance of the heavens? Can you establish their role on earth?" And then, having heard God's voice, Job surrendered immediately. Oh, and he said, "I have uttered words that I did not understand. Things too wonderful for me did I not know. Now my eyes see thee. I therefore despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." We are nearing the denouement. God wins. A victorious God settles his and Job's accounts with his friends. And God says to the friends, "My wrath is kindled against you, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant has." Job is vindicated, rehabilitated. He became God's servant again. He enjoyed his reward as the head of a new family, wealthier than before and perhaps even happier than before. His three daughters, endowed with names of their own, for the most beautiful among the women in the land, is in the text. All is well that ends well. What does the story teach us? So, in conclusion, Job's tale deserves to be read and understood on various levels. On the religious and metaphysical levels, his dilemma is simple: to believe or not to believe in his faith in God, whose justice is also compassionate. If his choice is to rebel against him, which could have been an option, then what good would it do to others? In all fairness, the same can easily, though not so easily, be said of his option, were as the head of a new family to continue believing in God. But what if the same God decided to repeat the same agonizing test inflicted on him and his children again? What change? Something did. As I said, God spoke. God spoke to Job. Why was Job satisfied with his response? He was satisfied simply because he had spoken. And that is the urgent yet timeless lesson we receive from his tale, if we read it from a purely ethical viewpoint. Isn't this the theme that runs through all our encounters, all our work, all our aspirations, all our thoughts, all our plans and all our meditations? We are against indifference. What is the Talmud if not an interpretation of that commandment, not to be indifferent? Thou shalt not stand idly by is one of the most beautiful, the most marvelous, the most human of all commandments. What is Hasidism if not a moving yet powerful appeal for being open to one another's pain, fear, and joy? Doesn't Job pray on behalf of his so-called friends who are being so rightly and severely reprimanded by God? Question then is, has Job forgiven God? Seemingly the answer is yes. The text doesn't say that. In fact, the four compliments that are so generously showered on him in the first verse, being a good and kind and so forth, are not being repeated. The text doesn't say that he became the same person he had been before his ordeal. He must have changed. How could he not? His inner protest endures. How could it not? But if it exists, it exists inside his faith. In other words, a believer can protest, may protest against heaven in the name of other victims, but only from within his or her faith. In doing so, one may even paradoxically fulfill God's will. Is this a valid theological option? I hope it is. It surely is a human one. For Job's story is also to be read and explored and even understood on a human level. It's a story not of beginnings, but of beginning again. Isn't this also an essential component of Jewish history? How many times did it compel us to build on ruins, ruins of homes, ruins of certainties, ruins of home, of culture, of hope? The fact that Job could marry or remarry and have children again and embark upon a new life with his discoveries, challenges, failures, and triumphs serves as a blueprint for all human beings everywhere forever. The story is being read again and again, for it occurs again and again. And yet we continue. Still there remains a note of distress, if not disappointment. A question. Why isn't Job told the truth? That he had not done anything to warrant punishment. That his suffering was nothing but a wager, a celestial game between Satan and God. Oh, the question is pertinent. The answer, the truth is told by the book itself. And here, listen to the end as it is in the text. It says, all of a sudden we read that Job's brothers and sisters and acquaintances arrived to break bread with him and bring him expensive gifts. Wait a second. He had brothers and sisters? Where were they when he was struck by catastrophe? Is it possible that they didn't know what happened to him? The three friends knew and they did not? Or is it that they came only when he didn't need them? What a strange happy end. Text says, and Job lived 140 years more, and so four generations of children and grandchildren. He dies an old man, saturated with years. In other words, nothing is forgotten, but perhaps all is forgiven. Has Job's faith remained pure as it had been long ago? Is all this possible? In the Zohar, the Holy Book of Splendor, there is an extraordinary hypothesis. He says, Job, in the hours of his extreme pain, actually did not lose his faith, but he lost his mind. He lost his sanity. How about Job being a prototype of a survivor? At one point in his life, he must have had a choice, giving up either his faith or his sanity. But at least I know one generation that has kept both. Isn't that the story that we so love, that we tell it and retell it again and again? Thank
you. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the first of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In the Bible, Job Revisited. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Boston University President Emeritus John Silber. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney and Ryan Peterson. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.